Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. Today's guest is one of the two authors of a new book that sets out to address the, quote, entanglement of epistemology, technology, and politics in digital modernity, and what studying that entanglement can tell us about the workings of power. The book is part of a series of research monographs that intend to encourage social scientists to embrace a complex systems approach to studying the social world. Let's dive right in.
Well, my name is Peter Thornburg. I'm assistant professor in computational social science at the University of Amsterdam. And the title of the book is Seeing Like a Platform, an Inquiry into the Condition of Digital Modernity. And it's written by me and my co-author, Professor Justus Uttermark.
Peter, can you tell me a little more about your research interests and, you know, how you kind of came to the point of writing this book? What would you characterize as your intellectual project?
So I've always been kind of interested in the intersection of the social and the digital world to a certain extent. In part, as I kind of grew up as a computer nerd, so I've always had that kind of, always been interested in programming and always kind of existed in that world. But then gradually become more interested in the social sciences and what kind of faces you when you make that transition, or at least what faced me was this kind of realization that there's not just a difference in what the topics are, but that there's a fundamental difference in what how we understand these systems. I really like the kind of epistemological questions. My PhD was in complex systems, which is very much this kind of application of methods from the physics and from computational sciences on the social world. And my brother, he's a sociologist. And so we would always have this kind of discussions and like we would kind of, on family dinners, live this kind of interface between the social world and the digital world and the computational and kind of notice how we thought differently of things. So that's the kind of bit always been my kind of broader project in using computational tools. And also at the same time as I've been kind of growing up and going into research has been the kind of transformation of society with society becoming increasingly digitalized and with the social sciences kind of adapting to that fact and to a certain degree going through an epistemic shift in itself and how we understand what society is. And so a lot of my research has been kind of tracing those shifts and tracing how the digital is transforming the social world, how it's transforming our politics, and the way we understand ourselves.
I'll point out you've been on this podcast before, in particular to talk about social media and polarization. And if I recall, you know, the paper that informed that conversation, you know, one of the things that you do is you often create essentially simulations. You do mathematics to try to understand various dynamics. Can you talk a little bit about that, about how you approach looking at these complex systems, what types of experiments that you get up to?
Yeah, so a lot of my works I kind of do all kinds of works in terms of using empirical, I've used digital data from the platforms. I've even done the occasional actual interview, actually engaging with humans. But a lot of my work is kind of focused on simulations. And so kind of building artificial models of the social world and kind of having it play out. And especially it's a technique called agent-based modeling that's actually existed since the 60s, 70s. It's existed for a long time. And what this allows you to do is basically to try to build this models that are as simple as possible, but captures the phenomenon that you're trying to study. And it very much kind of comes from a kind of physics or natural science understanding of the social world in the sense that we're trying to model the social world from the bottom up. So we're trying to capture humans and what the humans do and then look at their interaction and how that can lead to often unanticipated outcomes on a higher level. So it's a little bit like if you would think a murmuration of starlings or like a flock of birds. If you would approach that as a social scientist would, it would be, you know, it would kind of have some variable, you would, you know, have a survey and some variables and then try to find correlations. And obviously that wouldn't be able to capture the kind of complex phenomenon that is a flock of birds because it's just interaction between many birds. But what does allow you to capture it in very simple ways is to basically create a little model where you have the birds as being rule followers and they're interacting. And that leads to this kind of flowing dynamic pattern that is the flock of birds. And so it comes with a certain understanding of what society is and how we should understand society, which is this notion that society is a complex system. And so that understanding, that sense that society is not, it's not just a complicated system, but it's a complex system, has been something that's been emerging over the last 30 years or so into social science and has really become quite a dominant understanding in recent years. So a lot of my work is both applying those methods, but also trying to, in doing so and in seeing this spreading of these ideas of society as a complex system, also being kind of critical in trying to understand what that actually means and what assumptions come with that kind of shift.
So you say in the introduction, of course, that you derive the title for the book from James Scott's Seeing Like a State, which many folks are introduced to in, you know, studying political science or studying social sciences generally. You also write that the proposition at the heart of Seeing Like a Platform is that the digital era into which we are now entering signifies the rise of a new epistemology of power. I want to kind of get into that, what you mean by that. But just to start, step back on seeing like a state, you know, why was that a kind of operative metaphor for you in going to do this work?
So first, it's an amazing book. And if the listener hasn't read it already, they definitely should. But what Scott kind of sets out to do, so he has this analysis of what the state is, when the state is trying to pursue some large project or trying to improve the world somehow. And he was looking at the state, you know, from the book was written in the 90s, and he's looking back on the state associated to kind of industrial modernity. So kind of from the 40s to the 70s, 80s. And his book is kind of a critique of that, of the ambitions of that state. It's often been read as kind of a critique of the state in general. But I kind of reread this book a few years ago, and I realized that it's not just a critique of state power or something that's innate to the state, but it's of a particular way of seeing, a particular way of that the state of that era understood and represented society. So how the metaphors that it used to understand society. And so I think it's useful to kind of think of what that metaphor was in order to kind of see of how we moved away from that metaphor in recent years. At least that's what we argue. And so the society that Scott looks at is the society of industrial modernity, or the kind of Fordist society. So it's a society that in many ways understood itself through the metaphor of industrial production. So the kind of Fordist factory, and this has been, you know, many sociologists have written about this, but the way that the industrial production, the mass production and the Fordist production that was central to this society, it became a kind of arch metaphor for understanding society itself. So in many ways it was exported. So the way that machines were structured became a way that we structured our production, structured our factories. And that in turn became exported and slipped into other parts of society. So schools, for instance, became to be structured as machines and as factories and large parts of our lives. So a lot of our parts of our institutions. So there's this way of understanding society as a kind of machine that can be designed, that can be controlled from the top down. And maybe here it's useful to come back. I mentioned already this notion of complexity, but I think it's a useful starting point to actually explain what we mean by complexity. And when we talk about complexity, we often separate, we kind of draw a line between complex systems on one side and complicated systems on the other side. And so a complicated system would be something like a car or a spaceship, a machine. So it's a system that we can kind of take apart and we can look at the components and we can see kind of what the components do. And the components they have their own little functions and mechanisms, and they interact in quite simple ways. So by studying the pieces of the machine, we can kind of understand the whole and we can design them as a top-down kind of way of structuring a system. So that is kind of the kind of epistemology, this way of understanding that was very characteristic of industrial modernity. But on the other side of that, we have complex systems. So that would be like an ant colony or a flock of birds or a school of fish. And what characterizes them is that you really can't take them apart to understand them, right? Like if you would take an ant from an ant colony and you would look at what it does, it would just like walk around in circles. It wouldn't really tell you anything, its behavior. And it's in some ways very stupid and dysfunctional in its own. It doesn't really fulfill a kind of function. But what happens when you have thousands or millions of them suddenly becomes a very intelligent organism on the kind of macro level. You have very simple components, but very complex interaction that leads to kind of types of order and types of function that can be very hard to predict from the underlying behavior of the components. What Scott and the broader critique that he was part of, he basically looked at this epistemology of industrial modernity, this idea that society is a complicated system, that we can build it like a machine and we can control what outcomes it has. And he was basically saying that this misrepresents society. When we see society as this, we're missing a lot of aspects of it. We have to do some kind of reduction in order to be able to control society. Powers and organization and control always require a kind of simplification to make society and to make system and to make nature kind of bureaucratically digestible, to make them possible to parse, to be able to kind of build a map of the system. But his critique basically focused on this idea that society is a complicated system. It misses a lot of things, and those things that we miss, they kind of come back and haunt the system, and they lead to often unanticipated and very problematic outcomes. And what we're basically arguing is that we have, since the kind of critiques of Scott and so on, we have gone through a kind of transition over time where we have increasingly seen the spread of metaphors of complexity, like self-organization, and this kind of organic ideas, that they have spread and become a kind of dominant way in which society understands itself and in which society is being organized. And that we've basically seen a shift from the metaphors that Scott critiqued to the kind of metaphors that in some ways Scott's promoted, which are the metaphors of complexity. But we also see that those metaphors and that epistemology also comes with its own limitation. It also leaves out aspects of society that we have to bracket and that in the same ways come back to haunt us.
So we talked about ideas that sort of in some ways are congruent with this in different ways on this podcast in the past. And I feel like I'm in particular reminded of a conversation had with Joe Bock Coleman and Carl Bergstrom and other authors of a paper on collective behavior and the ways in which technology is changing the way that humans essentially interact with one another, and raising this kind of question of, you know, do we really understand the way that digital technology has, you know, changed human organization fundamentally down to, you know, the level of how we interact individually and then, of course, in groups. So I'm thinking about your ants, I'm thinking about, you know, fish, I'm thinking about birds and, you know, all of those kind of more complex systems. And then also, of course, thinking about humans now as a species of many billions that attempt to organize themselves in different ways to accomplish collective goals. You talk about the idea that the digital creates potential for alternative and more equal forms of organization, but it also, of course, at the same time, affords new forms of control and inequality through the monopolization of data power. So I kind of understand your goal here as thinking about the complex system and then thinking about, you know, how power is accrued in it and thus, you know, how decisions get made. You regard technology as Janus-faced. You say it could be employed to undermine democratic power, weaken public services, promote labor precarity, violate privacy, destabilize the world's democracies. But its political possibilities could also potentially enable new forms of democratic governance. I assume your project is hopefully in furtherance of that latter statement. Where do you think we're at the moment, just on this question? What is the balance at present in terms of how digital technology is being deployed in the world? How far off from that more pluralistic or democratic goal do you think we are?
I mean, I think it's quite clear looking historically of when digital technology and social media and the internet first kind of arrived, right, and became influential, how we were talking about it, but also how it was actually employed. And we saw the rise of early, I guess they weren't really called platforms back then, but like Wikipedia, Couchsurfing, even early Airbnb, it was kind of like a beautiful place in some way. And we had this idea of like the sharing economy, and that the digital could allow us to basically function as a way of creating flexible institutions, which wouldn't require kind of top-down control, which wouldn't require necessarily monetary exchange, that we could have like ways of producing new forms of conviviality and other forms of non-monetary and non-controlled exchange. And so there was all of that optimism. And of course, that was also expressed in kind of the Arab Spring and the political movements, Barack Obama's campaign in 2008, which very much employed this kind of grassroots movement and so on. And there was in that period, especially, there was a lot of use in the left of this kind of notions of complexity and of self-organization. And the way that that became kind of ways of describing how we could organize a society from the bottom up. And so there was this great deal of optimism there. And what we then saw gradually was that there was an inflow of financial capital in this arena. And there's also this sense that, you know, like the, among theorists and sociologists, there was this way of describing that the digital technology would be kind of inherently incompatible with capitalism because it's the digital is not scarce, and scarcity is a kind of a precondition for capitalism. And so we had this kind of the pirate movement, the kind of free software movement, and information wants to be free, and all of these ideas that kind of were entangled in a large shift. But when financial capital, what was kind of realized from the position of financial capital is that these platforms not only reduce intermediation, they not only allow people to connect directly, but in some ways they actually mediate a lot of interaction. So when we're exchanging messages through Facebook instead of doing it in person, we actually have an intermediary part that actually has a lot of power in that relationship. And so you had a shift where data started becoming valuable and capital started to recognize that there were actually real forms of control in this intermediation, that you could accumulate data, you could predict user behavior, and you could also shape user behavior in important ways and in ways that very much are invisible to the users and where the outcomes are very hard to predict. And it's hard to actually notice that you're being controlled and that your behavior is being shaped. And so with that, we've kind of seen a growing influence of these platforms that basically use this monopoly, this kind of position of control of the flow of information and as kind of fundamental infrastructure, social and political infrastructures of our society. They're using that as a way of extracting rent. And it's become kind of characteristic of a new form of capitalism that is very much based on social and political forms of control. And so I would say that it's very clear that we've moved in the direction of this much more centralized forms of power, where financial capital is very much coming to take control and shaping our society. And a lot of these consequences, like with Bob Coleman and so on, I think it's really amazing work, because it also highlights the way that manipulating and having these companies coming in and taking control and reshaping the very fundamental rules of our information ecosystem that shapes how we as society act and how we take decision and how we solve our problems. It reshapes our society in really unexpected and unpredictable and really dangerous ways. And is also often in some ways orthogonal to what the companies are trying to do, because what they're trying to do is basically maximize the data that they can extract from us, maximize how much attention they can extract from us. And then the downstream consequences that reshaping of our information ecosystem that has on our politics and our social life is really something external that they don't necessarily really care about.
You look at various phenomena across the book. You look at things like Anonymous. You look at Wikipedia in particular. I want to pause on Wikipedia. This phrase, democratic potential, comes up multiple times in the book. and you look at Wikipedia as a kind of case study, asking this question about how power concentration works on Wikipedia, how this, you know, self-organization, or the bureaucratization of self-organization works on Wikipedia. Why is Wikipedia such a useful case study to get at these ideas?
So Wikipedia is and really remains the kind of leading example of how self-organization can go right and how we can actually create systems that are non-monetized and non-controlled and really amazing and beneficial for society. And so we wanted to kind of look closer to on this case and see whether it lives up to this description of being a kind of decentralized self-organized systems and how it actually works. And so that's the kind of aim when we look at it. And when in trying to think of it, okay, it is a very successful example. And everyone keeps using it as a metaphor for how we can organize our society differently. But how is it actually organized? We talk about self-organization, but what does it mean? And I think what we find and what I find really interesting is that the reason that it works is maybe not so much that it's decentralized and it lacks control and institution, that it's bottom up, but precisely that it has actually quite a lot of bureaucracy. It has quite a lot of institutions. It had a lot of rules and a lot of control to enable to make it democratic. And so it's not that it's just a completely self-organizing system without any control. There's actually a lot of institutional, a lot of top-down control taking place. And it's precisely what enables it to be democratic and inclusive. And in some ways, we can think of this as kind of, there's this classic anthropology book from the 90s written by, I forget his first name, Orr is the surname, talking about machines. And so in his book, it's very much in the kind of spirit of seeing like a state, because it's a critique of this notion of industrial society as being possible to plan from the bottom, from the top down. And so this idea of society as being just a machine. And so what he does is basically is talking to, in this anthropological studies, hanging out with Xerox repairmen. And they have this big book that describes everything that they're supposed to do, depending on what's wrong with the printer. And they have this exact rules that they're supposed to follow in this top-down institution. And what he finds is that actually no one is actually following this book. No one is following these rules. And the actual reason that it's working, that these repairmen are successful, is that they're having this horizontal exchange. They're exchanging stories, narratives, and they're building kind of internal norms. And that is in many ways a kind of bottom-up institution. And that's just one example of a lot of kind of studies showing the kind of failures of industrial modernity, that the way that industrial modernity actually functioned was that there was the presence of a lot of bottom-up structures. And to a certain degree, that critique has become part of the emergence of this kind of digital society that we live in today, that is very much organized around the ideas of complexity and the ideas of self-organization. And this chapter, you can kind of think of as a kind of opposite intervention, that what enables these complex bottom-up systems to work is that they're not only bottom-up self-organized, but that they also have top-down institutions. They have things that prevent them from going in a bad direction and that enable them to be democratic and inclusive.
I want to ask you a question about the larger social media platforms and how you kind of diagnose the problems that we see in those at the moment. You talk about the idea of political discourse on social media as self-presentation. You relate it to this idea that we see the public world as projected on our selfhood in social media, that information, thoughts, and stories are all seen in values as ways of expressing who we are. I tie this in my head back to your earlier work on polarization that we talked about. You say the political discourse that is afforded by social media is one based on the underlying mechanisms of identity and group belonging. Why does that matter? Where does that leave us stuck? What are the implications of that for democracy?
So the central argument in that chapter is really this idea of what happens to media when it's reorganized around the interests of data extraction and attention optimization. Because what the social media companies are profiting from is their selling data about who we are and our personalities, and they to companies, because they're part of an economy that is basically oriented around creating demands, which is very different if we look historically from and how the media was organized in during Fordism, during industrial modernity. It was very much a mass media that saw its purpose as catering to a mass audience. And it was very much trying to produce markets for very homogenous products. So this, you know, this old slogan, you can buy Ford in whatever color you want, as long as it's black. So that was kind of the economic structure that defined media, and that therefore that to a certain degree defined our culture, the need to kind of control a certain market, which is often relatively small, like a city, and the media was trying to basically achieve local monopolies. And that meant that they created incentives to cater to all audiences and being able to communicate to a diverse audience, basically, and being able to, for instance, in terms of politics, being able to communicate to voters of all parties. That in turn led to the need to produce a separation of what was seen as objective, what was seen as fact and non-debatable. So this kind of the shared space of what we all agree on versus the kind of space of these are things that we can disagree about, that we can, you know, have different opinions about. And then they're defining the kind of things that were outside the realm of polite society, of things you couldn't disagree about or you couldn't have debates about. So that kind of distinction between those different parts and this idea that there are shared facts in our society, that was very much a product of, in this way of understanding, of the type of the mode of production, of how industries produce products and how those products were markets were created for those products. Fast forward to the society we have today, which is a society where products are, it's a highly kind of postmodern society where the limitation is not the production, but it is the need to create demand and identify certain consumer niches, which in turn creates this value of data as a commodity, as a form of capital in contemporary society, because it is understood to be the kind of product that allows us to produce consumer demand and produce identities and consumer groups. And that demand on media, it creates a media where the platforms and the systems are designed for the purpose of extracting information about who we are. And there's a lot of research showing kind of what you need to do if you want to maximize data extraction. So one thing you want to do is make people talk about themselves and who they are, right? Because that's how you find out who they are, so you can sell that information to advertisers. And then you want to maximize how much they're looking at the screen, how much they're engaging, and how much they're writing. And it turns out, just because of human nature, that the way you do that is by making people angry and upset. You're threatening their identity somehow, and you're making them talk about themselves. And basically what you realize when you see what that optimizes for, it's also precisely the things that you would like to optimize for if you want to maximize effective polarization, you want to maximize conflict, you want to maximize kind of sectarianism in society. And so basically that produces the conditions that drive societal conflict, that drive kind of fragmentation and a breakdown of social cohesion.
You point to our political discourse essentially boiling down to a form of self-expression, highlighting difference, fueling identity conflict. You've just spoken to that phenomenon. And you write, as the boundary between opinion and fact dissolves and both become drawn into the logic of difference, the question of truth becomes submerged into the larger process of cultural fragmentation and difference. This means that the emerging epistemology of digital capitalism treats truth as a question of identity. Information is evaluated based not on common standards of evidence applied to commonly accepted facts, but on its alignment with our social identity. I want to just ask you to kind of explain the cash value of that idea, maybe relate it to issues that we face right now, inequality, climate change, you know, other things that we need to address collectively. How does this hold us back?
So basically, when you're moving into society where you don't have a shared set of facts and you don't have this value around rationality and reasoning, and you don't have a kind of space where there is the sense that this is a specific space where we can disagree and we can argue, but we're doing so based on a shared set of facts. When you no longer have that, and the way that things are communicated and the way that information, that opinions and action is valued is basically as identity markers that somehow situate you in the same way that we're buying certain t-shirts to express who we are, to say something about our identity. When politics becomes drawn into that space of identity, it reduces or erases any space for kind of rational disagreement, where we can kind of have a conversation and arrive at some kind of compromise. Because there is no purpose for compromise. The idea is not, if you have ideas and opinions as markers of your identity, that leaves no space for arriving at a kind of compromise or at a shared set of ideas, because that's not the point of those ideas. You're not taking on those opinions as because of some kind of rational reason. You're doing so because it links you to a certain identity. It links you to a certain social group. And these are just the kind of expressions, they're just kind of superstructures of fundamental group identity and group differences. And it becomes very hard to see how such a society can, in the long term, continue to function.
This book is dense. It's a complicated set of ideas here. But, you know, coming back to ants and ant colonies, you know, and the idea of resistance or refusal to participate in the incentives and the goals of the larger colony, there is a kind of set of concerns here or preoccupation with the idea of resistance, how to resist complex power, how to resist the phenomena that you're describing here, that platforms, how they're shaping our behaviors, et cetera. But you write, you know, a little later in the book, that this idea that, you know, attempts at resistance in this world of complex power of digital capitalism are inherently co-opted. And that kind of creates a kind of conundrum, I think, for those who might want to address the fundamental power concerns or the power issues. I don't know. I just want to ask you about that word resistance. You know, what does this book tell us about resistance against these forms of complex power or digital capitalism that you describe here?
Yeah, I think a really kind of central point that we arrive at through this analysis is to question this really inherent association that we've developed, I would say over recent decades, where we associate decentralized, bottom-up, self-organized systems to democracy, and we associate top-down systems, institutions, bureaucracies, hierarchy to kind of totalitarianism. And that there's that kind of separation has really come to characterize, I would say, especially the left, this kind of fear of institutions, fear of structure. And that leads to, that becomes really, makes it very difficult to organize resistance, basically. And what you often end up with is that this finding, which we find again and again, is that self-organized systems, bottom-up systems, they don't necessarily lead to positive outcomes. They don't necessarily lead to inclusion or equality. In fact, they have really a strong tendency to become highly centralized, and with some people ending up in power, they're also very sensitive to manipulation. They're very sensitive to control. And so I think a kind of main takeaway for us is this idea that resistance, we shouldn't be so afraid of building institutions. We shouldn't be so focused on, or we shouldn't conflate decentralization with egalitarianism or with democracy, because it's just a false association, and it makes resistance very challenging.
towards the end of this book, you start to ask questions about artificial intelligence, how it may change the phenomena that you describe here. You pose a set of questions to end the book. They're almost, I suppose, like a challenge to other researchers, other people thinking about these things. Questions like, you know, how does AI perpetuate inequalities? Who owns the AI state? What are AI minorities? What is politics in the era of AI? Let me just kind of pause on a question I think that underlies a lot of these, which is you seem to be concerned about the combination of state power and corporate power and, you know, the extent to which AI kind of blurs that line. How should we be thinking about artificial intelligence as we think about this platform economy that you're describing?
It's an interesting thing because a lot of the focus on, especially, you know, when these new AI systems first emerged, is this fear of kind of a Terminator scenario, right? That they will destroy the world in pursuit of paperclips, which is, I'm not saying that that fear is entirely unwarranted, but it does ignore a much more kind of obvious and direct fear, which is the fact that these systems are, which are clearly extremely powerful, that they are being implemented and controlled by precisely the same platforms that manage to turn couch surfing into the kind of city-destroying system that is Airbnb, that managed to create things like Facebook and Twitter that are kind of destroying our social fabric and our politics. And those companies are now in control of this extremely powerful AI systems. I think that is something we should be very much concerned about, because these are companies that the entire platform business model is founded on leveraging socio-political control to extract rents, to basically try to achieve monopoly markets by creating an artificial forms of scarcity by having basically monopoly control. That I find profoundly disturbing. And the way that those systems are now being, in the same way as social media, coming to seep in through our institutions, as, you know, people in, you know, the government and companies are starting to use them for everything, more or less condoned by leaders. But that gives an immense amount of control to these companies that I think is just, we should be very much probably more concerned about than in the Terminator scenario.
You write, by reducing political decisions into optimization problems, algorithmic systems erase the inherent intractability and pluridimensionality of politics. I think that's the stuff of democracy, and foreclose the possibility of other ways of understanding the world and other ways of being. You know, I don't know, suppose, what gives you hope? What are you looking at out there in the world that would suggest to you we have some way around this? I mean, you say that, you know, these things aren't preordained. They are, of course, the result of decisions that people are taking, that leaders are taking, that entrepreneurs are taking, that all of us are taking in our engagement with these ideas. What gives you hope?
I would say that this is, that we are, to a certain degree, at a kind of moments of shift, of moment of change, right? Because we see this large language models and AI kind of undermining the way that we've organized things, that they are really seem in many ways incompatible with how we structure things. And I think it's very clear. And what we're kind of pointing to is the risks of that, the ways that that can really threaten what remains of our democratic politics. But I think that that is just as much, those moments are also moments of opportunity, right? There's things changing. And if we're capable of organizing, capable to respond, I think those moments of change can also lead to something positive. I think, for instance, we see social media as a model is kind of being threatened. We see the media models that have shaped the internet and advertising models being basically undermined by AI models. I'm not saying that that is looking very positive at the moment, but I do think that there is a kind of clear sign that this is a moment of change, that are also moments of opportunity, that we can, if we're able to organize and if we're able to find new models, can lead to something positive.
This book is called Seeing Like a Platform, An Inquiry into the Condition of Digital Modernity. It's from Routledge, and I should say it's available open access. So folks can go and simply download the PDF on the internet. I'll make sure to link to it in the show notes here. Petra Tornberg, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me.
Thank you. It was great.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to my guest, thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones, and thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.